Well, shalom. This is Charlie Bernhout. What I'm presenting right now is the first part of an almost two-hour interview that I did with Sholem Caleb on September 10th, 2017. I'm very pleased to have with me Sholem Caleb, who is a famous American and Jewish music theorist, musicologist, cantor, conductor, and composer. We're going to be discussing his monumental works, his magnum opus. We'll hear more details about that. Shalom, how are you?
Baruch Hashem.
Okay. Why don't you begin by just telling us a little bit of your background? I know you were born in Dallas in 1929.
Correct.
Okay, and then tell us what life was like in Dallas and how long you stayed there, and just tell us a little bit about your history.
Well, I think to the listeners of this program, I should talk about how it related to my eventual life's activities. I think what would be of interest to start with is by describing how my father taught me first.
He was a chazan?
He was not a chazan, but his father had been a chazan, and an older brother of his, they were both chazanim in Russia, and he, as I said, he taught me first. He taught me to notate music, to read and write music, at a very young age. He taught me to be a Bal Kore, so that I read the full Sedra at my Talmud Torah at age 9,
really?
For my 9th birthday, as a matter of fact. He then taught me to be a child chazan.
You said you were a child chazan at the age of 9.
Well, that was a little later. He taught me to read the Torah by age 9.
Okay.
And then he taught me to be a child chazan. And a very important part of my early education was the fact that chazanim used to come to Dallas in those days. I'm talking about the late 1930s, early 1940s. These were depression times, and many chazanim did not have yearly positions, so they would come to Dallas to daven a Shabbos. And my father would explain to me their strengths, their weaknesses. This is part of my early education, and it might interest the listeners if I say that I began noticing at a very early age that the chazanim that I would hear and repeated Friday nights, Shabbos mornings, that there was a certain sameness to all of them, though they all had their individuality. And I remember asking my father, how could one explain this? Because they came from different places. I'm sure many of them never knew each other.
Right.
How do they know the same thing? My father's answer to me was that probably that which they know, it came from Shamayim. What he was referring to, of course, was Nusach HaTfilah.
Right.
And of course, it had evolved over centuries. And I mentioned that in my works, in my written works, it illustrates the power of oral tradition, that it was so strong that people who didn't know each other came from different countries, from, let's say, south of Russia, around Ukraine, Romania, all the way to the north, in countries, let's say, as far as Lithuania, Latvia, and as far as, let's say, Leningrad in Russia, those days, right. Petersburg. And yet they knew something the same. It was that strong that by oral tradition, people just knew it and clung to it.
Well, I think that's very important to note that there were no recordings until 1900, so it was an oral tradition And of course, the printing press was around 1450 or 60. So there really wasn't that much printed material. So it had to be an oral tradition.
Not only that, especially the cantors in Eastern Europe had very little music education. Those that had were the great exceptions, because the anti-Semitic climate of the Tsarist Russian Empire, where there was a quota system, and very few Jews got an education altogether, let alone a conservatory, music conservatory education. And so most of them could not even read or write music. One very famous example, of course, would be Kvartin. He was known not to be literate that way. And yet, he and so many other Chazonim, another, by the way, was Berel Chagi, that did not have that kind of education, but they all absorbed the atmosphere, not only the melody of Nusach HaTfilah, but the feelings that were brought out through it.
One of the things that I noted when I go to the biographies of the greats from the Golden Age and a little before is that they all sang in choirs as children. And I know you sang in a choir also and became a choir leader. And I think one of the great things that happened was they absorbed something from being part of that choir, listening to a great cantor. And that was the way it was passed on. And sadly, we don't have choirs today with young kids who can really absorb it at a young age. It's almost non-existent. I know we'll talk about your choir that you did some wonderful work with, but I think the choir was a very integral part in passing on the tradition.
I can speak directly to that, because in Dallas, there was one chazan who had his own choir, and he was really an excellent chazan. His name was Reuven Kaplan, and I was able to, my father wasn't sure that I'd be accepted into the choir initially, but when the chazan met with me, he did admit me into the choir, and he created solos for me to sing also in the choir. But that which you're describing, that was my first experience of that kind, just being able to listen and absorb is another episode in my life that I could describe to you. It's on this direct subject. In my youth, when I was still in Dallas, one of the guest chazanim was Shmuel Vigoda.
Really?
And he had a little choir that he formed from the children, the young men of the community. And I was in that group with him. At that time, it was 1940. I was 11 years old. And I knew of him. What I had known of him by that time was that he was the immediate successor of Yossele Rosenblatt, whose records I had heard from my father's and my grandfather's houses. And I was enamored just by the fact that I would be standing right next to someone of that kind of stature. Well, one of the tefillos that he sang on that Shabbos was the what they call the Groese Avarachmim, Avarachim Shochim Eromim. I don't remember a single note from it, but I do remember the atmosphere that it created. It was something that remained with me throughout my life, so that as an adult, when I was trying to write a piece for Avrachmi for myself as a chazan, I wrote one starting from Hanina Goyim Amo, and as I said, I didn't remember a note from what Vigoda sang, but I remembered the feeling that it created, and it's that which inspired my Hanina Goyim Amo, which in later years, David Bagley, Olav HaShalom, sang and actually recorded.
I was thinking of Bagley with his recording. Yeah, he was wonderful.
And that comes from what we're talking about, mm-hmm. just picking up the atmosphere, that the atmosphere, to a large extent, created the notes.
Oh, this is perhaps a little out of order, but I think a problem, you know, we're discussing the issues that Chazanim are facing today. Young people are exposed to many different talents and non-talents, unfortunately. And what can you do if a person doesn't really have the talent to be a proper chazan? And you're exposed only to that experience, you're turned off from chazanis at a very young age, unfortunately. That seems to be an issue. I mean, there are good chazanim, whatever that means, and not so good.
Well, of course.
And if your exposure is to one who is not a good chazan, it does have a problem in shaping the attitude towards chazanis.
I can speak to that also directly. In recent times in Baltimore, where there was someone who considered himself a chazan and was introduced as a chazan, and the people were turned off for very good reason, not mm-hmm. because of his chazonas, but they presumed it to be chazonas and gave it a bad reputation.
Right, right. This is something we have to come up with a way to solve that. Let's go back to from Dallas. You went to Chicago at the age of 14.
Yes.
And you were with this Cantor Kipper. Was he in Chicago?
Yes.
And you sang in his choir?
Well, the way that worked out, my family came to Chicago in 1942. It was around this time of year, maybe a few weeks sooner, not much. And I don't remember now who told us about Cousin Kipper, but we called him, and he auditioned me and felt that he couldn't say no to someone of my background, and so he took me into the choir, and he wanted me to sing some solos for him, but he didn't have them written. So I asked him if he would sing them for me so I could notate them and I could read them back. That would be the fastest way for me to learn. Well, he looked at somebody at that time, 13 years old, sort of incredulously. Well, he did it, and I sang the solos to him, and he was really quite overwhelmed. But that put an idea into his head. He knew at that time a chazan, Todrus Greenberg, who was really a marvelous chazan, but he was functionally blind, so he was not able to read or write. He couldn't even, his eyes were not good enough for that, but he was a great chazan. And so Chazan Kipper thought that if he could put the two of us together, that I could notate his chazonas, mm-hmm. and Chazan Kipper himself could directly benefit from it. And so after the Yom Neroim, he arranged that appointment. We came to Chazan Greenberg's apartment, and Greenberg didn't quite believe what he had told him about me. So he called me over to the piano, and he asked me to notate, I remember, like today, a Hineni Mochan Mezumen from Sphira.
Okay.
And I took it down, phrase by phrase, and I stopped him when I felt I had to take time to notate. Well, after a while, he said to me, well, could you sing back what I sang to you? And I sang it back with every detail, every chazonische knetch, because I was very careful not to miss any detail. He was so impressed, so overwhelmed. He was smoking a cigarette. He close to choked on the cigarette from disbelief. And I remember Chazan Kipper bursting out in laughter of satisfaction because I had proven his point. Well, this was the beginning of an association with Chazen Greenberg for some 34 years, in which time I not only notated his chazonas, but I, in time, directed him to sing for me his entire Siddur and Machzor, which ultimately became published in four volumes.
Was Greenberg in Chicago at the time?
Yes.
Okay. And okay, so
well, that was just the beginning of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
For me. But ask whatever you wish.
No. I note that when you were 17, you enrolled in Roosevelt University.
Before that, there's some things that I think you would
go ahead.
You would want to know.
Of course.
One of the wonderful things about Chicago was that at that time, I was still able to hear in person chazonim like Pinchuk, Kvartin, Moshe Kusevitzky. As a matter of fact, when I heard Moshe Kusevitzky, it was his first year in Chicago, I think the first Yom Neroim in the United States after the war. And I had the opportunity of those years to still hear chazonim who had choirs in four-part harmony with boy sopranos and altos and adult men, tenors and basses, still singing some of the classic choral compositions like from Azazel Rovner and Kalachnik, Nisi Belzer. I was still able to hear those live, and they made a tremendous impression on me. At the same time, one of the chazonim in that area of Chicago where we had moved was Chazon Yehoshua Lind. He was well known, considered surely among the top chazon of Chicago at that time. And he was quite a menagen. He had been a meshorer of Zeil Rovner himself for 2 years.
And in Odessa?
It wasn't in Odessa, but...
In Europe.
In Eastern Europe. Right. And he traveled with Zeil Rovner for a period of 2 years. He was a regular member of his choir. So he really had a rich background. He was very gifted. He wasn't schooled formally in harmony, but he had a tremendous ear for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he created his own compositions for choir. And I had the opportunity of hearing something like that for the first time in my life at age 13. And it made an enormous impression on me. And in later years, he come to know me. One reason was that one of the activities that resulted from what I've described to you is that when I was 15, I joined a religious Zionist organization at that time called Apollo Mizrahi.
Okay.
It was the youth organization of the Mizrahi, and they wanted to have a choir, and they had someone doing something like what they called Makela, but there was another person in the youth organization told them, if you want it really done right, this is the guy who can do it, pointing to me. So the one who was leading the choir asked me, well, would you come up? And so to start out, I had to think fast. One of the songs they were singing at that time was one of the early Zionist songs, Ba'a Menucha Le'ageya. So quickly, I worked it out to a four-part setting, and I taught soprano, alto, tenor, bass. When they heard the first strains of it in harmony like that, to them it was something like a miracle. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the Hashom Radati Choir, which in those years, pre-State of Israel, when Zionist rallies were very prevalent and very important in the Jewish community, the choir became known. We sang these kinds of songs of the early Zionist period, and my name became known through that among chazonim throughout the city of Chicago, to an extent that at one point, when Chazon Greenberg wanted me to direct the ensemble of the chazonim organization, the Chazonim knew of me and accepted me, and I became the conductor. By that time, I was in my early 20s.
Uh-huh.
And for a period of 4 years, I was the regular conductor of the Chazonim, of 25 Chazonim sang in the choir. And among those were the most prominent Chazonim of Chicago of that time.
I'm fascinated by the idea that Chicago had so many major Chazonim, because today there are a few Chazonim around, Alberto Mizrahi and others, but it sounds like it was really a center for Chazonim.
Oh, and in those days, there were at least a dozen, really, Chazonim who anybody would consider outstanding.
Interesting.
And another experience I had with Lind, which became very important, when I was 18, 1948, he asked me to become his choir leader, which was really an enormous kavod for me, knowing what he was like, the kind of chazan that he was, the kind of composer that he was. And that year, as I see this is like the hand of Hashem, who we say the bracha every day, Amechem Esari Gover, who sets the steps of man. I can see it in retrospect. Before the Yom Narayim, Lin saw the opportunity to come to New York. He had been in New York earlier, but at that time, he was offered a position. He came back to New York, and I was left with his choir, and there was a problem for him, because at that time he was teaching three young men to be chazonim. And in those days, it was also a time when chazonim schools were started for the first time. There hadn't been anything like that in the United States earlier, but this was shortly after the Holocaust, and so that source from which Chazonim had really learned, they acquired the background that they had for Chazonis, it was brutally destroyed in the Holocaust and earlier in the Russian Revolution. And so Lind was one of the first to write out his entire siddur in Machzer, prayer by prayer, and he had written it out in four books. And he was teaching his students from those books, so that they didn't learn it the way Chazonim used to from the background, just by picking it up, because that environment no longer existed.
Right.
So he was not the only one, but he was the first in Chicago to do that. And one of his students was a son of a lawyer, and this father, the lawyer, told Chazan Lind, he said, until you've signed a contract to teach my son to be a chazan, and until you fulfill that, you're not going anywhere, which really created a tremendous problem for Lind.
Oh, wow.
But he thought to himself, he could let me continue coaching them from his book. But in order for that to happen, I had to have a copy of the book. And in those days, he was selling it for $1,500 a copy. In those days, that was really a great deal of money, and I certainly didn't have it.
Or even today.
Right. So I told him, but if you want me to do it, I will have to have a copy of your book. And so he looked at his wife and she at him, and they realized they had no choice, and they agreed to it. They would have never done that under any other circumstance. But for me, it was two things. Number one, it gave me access to his entire siddur and machzer for the entire year.
Mm-hmm.
And through it, I was able to learn nuschos for Yom Narayim that I never knew. And I don't know how I might have ever learned them, but there I had them black on white, and I could easily read them. In looking at the notes, I could hear him sing them. And in addition, by teaching these three students of his, the word got around in Chicago that Shalom Caleb was a teacher of Chazonim and Chazonas.
Right.
And I got other students from that. In addition, I had another source of education because I was notating Chazon Greenberg's on a regular basis. So I had his Nusach and Chazonas as well as Lin's. So for me, it was like a trove of background information. And in those years, just shortly after that, in Chicago, the Chazonim felt that they had to organize a school similar to the ones being organized in New York.
Was that the Jewish Music Institute?
Yes, it was called the Jewish Music Institute of the College of Jewish Studies in those days. Since then, it's been called the Jewish Institute for Jewish Aspertus, Institute for Jewish Studies. That's still in existence.
In Chicago?
The Aspertus, yes. Uh-huh. But the Department of Teaching Chazonis, that doesn't exist now.
Uh-huh.
But it began around 1950, and I taught in that for about 9 years. And the other two faculty members, I shouldn't put it that way, I was number three. The number one was Greenberg. Second was Moses Silverman of Anshiyim at Synagogue, and I was the third.
Uh-huh.
And so that is part of my background in Chicago.
Well, you conducted a choral ensemble in 1953. That was the Cantorial Association of Chicago.
Right.
So that's very, very interesting. Now, you met your wife, Goldie, in 1954.
Well, actually, we married her in 1954.
You were married.
I married her in 1953.
Uh-huh.
It might interest you that when we were going out, she asked me what I did for a living. And at that time, I told her I was a chazan. But I told her I didn't expect the profession to last another 10 years. Now, since there we have some outstanding chazonim today, so you would say that I was completely off the mark. However, when you take into consideration that the overwhelming majority of shuls the world over do not have chazonim, and the overwhelming majority of people who attend synagogues prefer not having a chazan there, I'm not sure that I was so wrong altogether. But at any rate, what this tells is that I was already aware of a problem that was occurring for Chazonis.
Right.
And if you don't mind, I want to mention something about that. The first position that I had, I was 19 years old, and shortly after...
That was in 1949.
And shortly after I got this position, the rabbi of the shul told me, Shalom, you should include more catchy tunes into your davening. Well, when
hire Karl Bach.
Well, he wasn't around yet.
I know.
Well, when I heard that, instantly, intuitively, I realized that any tefillah that I would put such a tune on would be lost to Chazonim and Chazonas forever. Why? Because I realized once we would give something like that, a light, popular style tune to a congregation, they would never let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, to take it away would be like taking a piece of candy away from a baby. And because of that, all the great recitatives, the great choral compositions written on that text would be lost forever. I also realized that thrusting that kind of tune on a tefillah would destroy the mood of that tefillah, and even more than that, it would negatively affect the atmosphere, the ambience, the holiness of the service as a whole. Instantly, I recognized that, and I was fearful of it ever since. As time progressed, I kept noticing a trend that began and just continued unrelentingly till today, and that is that the people wanted ever less chazonis in the service, and at the same time they wanted more of these catchy tunes, particularly the more lively ones.
To participate also, it seems to be...
That's a catchword.
Yes. Well, all this lays the groundwork for your coming up with your magnum opus, but I just want to review for our listeners. In 1962, you got your master's degree in music theory at DePaul University. In 1966, you got your PhD in music theory at Northwestern.
And well, not exactly. I had finished my coursework in 1966.
Okay.
But until I finished my dissertation and got the degree, it was 1973.
Okay, but from 69 to 99, you were professor of music theory at Eastern Michigan University.
Correct.
So your background is quite steep in musical theory, to say the least.
Right.
During that period, when did you first come up with the idea that you should undertake this incredible project, what we call the magnum opus, your great, what is opus, your great opus?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, in order for me to explain that,
okay,
I would want first to explain to your audience, so that they may know what I'm going to say. I'm not sure they know 100%. I want to play a recording that will illustrate where we came from. Before I do, let me just explain
sure.
a little bit. From the very beginning of my education, when my father first taught me, whenever I would sing back to him what he taught me, he would remind me, remember before whom you are standing. Remember who you are talking to. And when I would sing back to him again, trying that, and I could see from the expression on his face if I actually was able to inject the kind of feeling that he required of me.
By the way, we call that neshama.
Yes, yes,
soul.
Yes, indeed.
I call soul music.
Yes, indeed. Well, part of that is what our people used to refer to in speaking in Yiddish using Hebrew words, perash hamilos, meaning the interpretation of the words. This was expected of the chazan in such a way to make them feel what the prayers were asking for, especially in Eastern Europe, when they were suffering from persecution from an anti-Semitic regime, which constantly came up with ever new edicts, cruel edicts, anti-Semitic edicts, which restricted where they could live, where they could not live, what occupations they could be engaged in, which occupations they could not. And at times it meant that they could be expelled from the places where they did live. They were always in danger of being attacked physically. They were in danger of pogrom, which could erupt at any time. And the tefillos, which speak about Hashem's saving us from these kinds of situations, have to have pity on us, to have mercy on us, that they expected the chazan to bring these feelings in such a way that would give them a comfort, like somebody was davening for them. Like the chazan was their real shliach tzibor, in a way, their defense attorney before the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To illustrate this, I would like to ask you to play the recording of Zavo Kvarte, 1 second.
Okay.
It's from Nila, from the Piyut on the Shloshesher Midos. And this is the fourth, the last stanza from it, Yihiratzon Shemea Kol Bichyos, which translates, may it be your will you who hears the voice of weeping, that you place our tears in your receptacle of tears for preservation, and save us from all cruel decrees, for to you alone do our eyes cling. Now, I'd like you to hear how Zavok Vartin brought that out. May it be your will. Listen how he's starting to plead. May it be your will. That's why I tried to say the words in English under,
of course,
his chanting to bring that into relief. But I wanted to say now that obviously when I talk about Parash Amilos' interpretation of the words, I could hardly think of any single example that could bring it out to that extent. But I want to mention that in Parash Amilos, this is not the only kind of expression that Chazonis projected. Another one, a very prominent one, was one of glorification, one of majesty. And for that, I don't have to go any further than to pick the very first verse from Kabbalah Shabbos. L'chunrana l'Hashem, nori l'atzur yishenu. Come, let us sing before Hashem. Let us cry out joyously to the rock of our salvation. Now, in this case, just the most basic nusach automatically does that. Even just that little bit alone, when you say, come, let us sing, let's cry out for joy, the nusach itself does that. The chazonim would deepen that somewhat, let's say with a little chazonis. Even that little bit.
Yes.
When you say, Nori al Hashem, let us sing to Hashem. Even something like that, it already brings that out. But when a choir was involved, it would even do so much, much more effectively. The piece that we're going to hear, it's done by Chazan, accompanied by choir. I want to mention that personally, I don't remember hearing this kind of composition even within my lifetime. However, I learned to know about them because in my magnum opus, which we'll be talking about a little later, I've included a few of these that I picked up from collections of Chazan from Eastern Europe. These partitur collections, which meant collections of written music for choir with chazan, sometimes without chazan. So I've included some of those. In addition, I wrote one myself as part of a commissioned work, which we'll talk about at a later point. And this is sung by a choir that I organized, also in connection for this. And the solo is sung by Chazan Alan Berman, who was a member of the choir. And now I'd like for you to listen to the way L'chunrana was expressed by Chazan with choral accompaniment.
Now, where was this? In Detroit?
Or it was in Baltimore.
In Baltimore. Oh, so it's more recent, rather recent.
About 10 years ago.
Okay.
Come, let us sing. Hashem. Come, let us sing. Let us cry out joyously.
Let's all our salvation.
flee. This is the way our synagogue music gave expression to glorification. Uh-huh. This is what I'm trying to say. This is in contrast to what we heard in Kvartin. And there are countless shades in between these two.
By the way, I've always rued the fact that there are so few choirs around, if you will. And one of my personal goals is to eventually have a New York choir. You know, you've got Johannesburg and Melbourne and all over the world, but very few here in this country.
Let me just say one thing about that. I remember from my own childhood, my parents wanted me to be a mashorer at the chazan. They considered it an honor. And this was true throughout the Jewish experience in Europe altogether, even before Western Europe, in West Central Europe as well, where they had boys and men's choirs, but especially in Eastern Europe, where opportunity was is difficult to come by, as we mentioned earlier. So this is one thing that parents wanted their children to be involved in. That kind of situation does not exist in our day, because in our society, which does not, thank God, does not know of the kinds of need and want that we just described about Eastern Europe, in this free, open, democratic society, young people have so many other competing interests. And by the way, this choir that I described earlier, I was hoping that I'd be able to record the numerous compositions that I have in my books for illustration. But for the very reasons we're talking about, it couldn't continue, because when springtime came and the baseball season began, some of the boys preferred going there than to come to rehearse for choir practice. And ultimately, that is why we lost enough of the boys that I had to give up the choir, unless I would ever sometimes have the money to be able to hire this kind of service. I'm afraid it can't happen. But in years back...
Well, you never know. The wheel goes around.
That's true.
I'm not giving up.
But I do want to say this much right now. What we've illustrated in the record by Kvartin and this example of Lechon Aronino, when this tradition flourished, when it was alive, it would have been unthinkable for these kinds of catchy tunes to be put into a service. It would be unthinkable. To give you one example as to how wrong I think these are, how bad they are, I would like to play for you a recording, a traditional recording of a tefillah, which then I want to illustrate by contrast catchy tunes for, to see the extremity with which the catchy tune destroys anything resembling devotion, holiness, anything related to it. So the piece that I have in mind is from the second Kedusha of Shabbos and Yontif, Mimkomo Huyifen Barachamim. The words are saying, from his place may he turn in mercy and grace the people who declare the oneness of his name evening and morning, each day regularly. they twice lovingly proclaim the Shema. The piece that I'm going to show you is also one that I created, although it is mine. The style is not mine. It's the one that I picked up. As a matter of fact, it was inspired by one that I remember hearing when Kvartin davened with a choir of boys and men, and I still remember that Mimkom Oifim Barachmim, and I had that in my ear when I was creating mine, which is in that style. And so I'd like you to play that. It is being performed here by Vienna Boys Choir, and the Chazan is Naftali Herstick, formerly the chief cantor of Jerusalem. It was recorded by the Milken Foundation in 2003, and I ask you to please play it. Blessed is Hashem. From his place, may he turn in mercy and grace the people the oneness of his name. Embrace the people and declare the oneness of his name. Embrace the people who declare the oneness of his name. This breathes holiness. Even in the morning, each day regularly, this text. I recall in one of these shuls where I functioned as chazan, the demand was extremely powerful, overpowering, and they had to sing the tune which they called traditional. It was traditional for them by the time I had become chazan in the shul, which went, Baruch Kavod Ad Hashem Imkomo Mimakamo Yifen Barachamim Vyahonam Hamyacharim Shema Erevavoker Bechayom Tahamim Pamay Miyahava Shema Omrim. Another example, which I don't know is, which one is worse. It could evoke tears, not from tefillah, but from the reality of something like this could actually take place. This is another catchy tune that I heard in one of the primary Frum Shuls in Baltimore, which went, Mehim kai mai ho yifen barachamim yahachainam hamiyachadim shemai ereva vayker bechoyohem tami hamahayim eyavah shemahayim. That's real cool, wouldn't you say? But the tragedy of it is that this trend started, as I said, in my career. I encountered it back in 1949, and is still going ever strong till today.
You know, there was a spoof about Chazanim in the end. I think it's also in film. Thus is Vos the public will.
Yeah, I remember that too well.
What do they know?
But tragically, that was for fun, and people laughed when at the end of it, the one who sang the song says that the final candidate came singing something in jazz.
Oh, yes, Yismach Moshe. Yes. It was Leibel Waldman doing the spoof from the 30s, by the way.
But tragically, this is not exceptional today, and it's not funny.
No.
It's the norm. It has become the norm.
Shalom, you talked about Peirosh Hamila.
Yes.
That's the soul.
Interpretation. Okay. Yes.
If I could digress for a couple of minutes. If people don't believe the words they're singing, or even understand the words they're singing, it's very hard for them to create soul music. Unfortunately, I see people mouthing words. I mean, I'm not such an expert. When I hear soul music, you know, I just define it. Maybe it's Peirosh Hamila. I don't know. But sometimes I hear someone singing, and I'm not even sure they understand the words, which is why they cannot have the interpretation. And then, even if they understood the words, if they don't believe in Hashem, or they don't believe that these prayers have any meaning other than just some sort of congregational exercise, you can't really have the true spirit of what we're seeking.
Well, I dealt with this question in the seventh chapter of my first volume of this magnum opus we're going to talk about later. The way I understand it, the way I experienced seeing it, as I noticed this trend, I noticed that the people in the congregation who were not able to grasp what I was trying to express in Chazonis, these were primarily native-born American Jews. In those days, and I'm talking about now, 60 to 70 years ago, they had very little education altogether. So I could understand where they didn't know what we're talking about, and that not only could they not understand it, even if they could, their life circumstances could not allow them to feel it. Now, when we consider today, we're talking about Orthodox, really strictly Orthodox congregations, where they do understand what they're saying. And I don't question their belief in Hashem at all.